I'm Hannah Young, and you're listening to The Caring Economy with Toby Usnick, sponsored by Philanthropic Impact.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Ladies and gentlemen, wherever you are in the world, welcome back to The Caring Economy with me, Toby Usnick. Today, my guest is Robert Eccles. He is of the Said Business School at the University of Oxford. He's the author of a number of books on integrated reporting, sustainability, and the role of business in society, something that we talk about regularly here. His focus is on sustainability from both a company as well as an investor perspective. Professor Eccles is also involved in a variety of initiatives that we're going to talk today that embed environmental, social, and governance, or what we call ESG, issues in the real world and decision making. One of these is the Sustainability Accounting Standards Board, or SASB, of which he was the founding chairman. In 2018, Professor Eccles was selected by Barron's as one of the top 20 influencers on ESG investing. Bob, welcome to The Caring Economy.
Good to see you, Toby. Thanks for the invitation.
So we first met in 2014 at the Harvard Business School when I was a student of yours and George Serafin's in the certificate program called Aligning Sustainability with Corporate Performance. And I was so impressed and valued that course. And over the years since, I've just been following your trajectory, and I just find it really actionable the way you engage business leaders and investors in ESG efforts. So I'm in sync with you, I think, and what you're about. But for our listeners who are perhaps less familiar with ESG, might you just give us a brief primer on what it is and, as importantly, why it matters?
Sure, happy to. So ESG is the acronym. Life is filled with acronyms, as you know, for environmental, social, and governance. And the basic point of ESG is that I think, you know, we all understand that companies need to make, you know, money for their shareholders over the long term, because we're all shareholders directly or indirectly in various ways. The contention is really whether or not paying attention to other stakeholders that are concerned about environmental issues like climate change, social issues like diversity, equity, and inclusion, or income inequality, do those matter to long-term value creation? And historically, and it's interesting because ideology factors into this a lot. Historically, when you said ESG, if people knew what it was, you said sustainability, right, and people argue over the different definitions of those, it was assumed that it was somehow losing money. It was giving up money. It was a transfer payment. It was some form of philanthropy. And I think the work that I've done with George, and George has done a lot more and other people, shows that actually, over the long term, those companies that are responsibly paying attention to the material, environmental, social, and governance issues, and SASB obviously factors into that, it's good for financial performance. And so boards of directors need to take that into account. And again, you get into this issue of fiduciary duty, and boards really represent the interests of the corporation, not short-term shareholders, even though I think people mistakenly kind of view it that way, even yes, with, you know, Delaware law. And so what we've seen, I think, is this you know, kind of arc where we've crossed the Rubicon from when you see ESG, people think that, okay, this is sort of philanthropy or investing where you're sort of, you know, giving up some return, concessionary investing is the term that people like to use, to know it's something that you need to pay attention to. And then I think there's a distinction between ESG and impact, and we can get into that later if you'd like.
Sure. Broadly speaking, it's a very specialized field in a sense, but we hear more and more about it. I believe ESG investing is now the fastest growing area of investing. But I wonder, what's the reception like? We've crossed the Rubicon, as you've said, but we're not out of it yet, right? We're not out of the woods, so to speak. There's still a lot of work to be done in raising awareness and engagement around this. You're talking to an executive at a publicly traded company. How do you get him or her to engage with this?
So first of all, and this may surprise you, I'm not a big fan of the term ESG investing. You know, I've written about this. I had a little piece in Forbes a couple of weeks ago called Vladimir Putin's, you know, contribution to ESG investing. And one of the points I made is, I think it's good that there's been this kind of change in narrative. Uh-huh. But a lot of what's being marketed as ESG investing, I think, is simplistic, and I think it's misleading, and I think it's greenwashing, to be honest. And so there's no really clear criteria for what is a so-called ESG fund. So people come out, and it's good that people think they should invest their money in a way that can make the world a better place and still get decent financial returns. Mm-hmm. But it's these simplistic approaches where they say, you know what? No oil and gas, no tobacco, no landmines. And so it's an ESG fund. It's a green fund. You know, it's loaded up with the fangs that have all kinds of issues around data privacy and dual class share structures and, you know, human rights in the supply chains. And so I think it's naive. So I'd like to see us get away from the term ESG investing, and talk more in terms of what are the material, environmental, social, and governance issues, the way SASB would think about it, that matter to value creation. So, for example, in a big manufacturing company, clearly carbon emissions is one, but in a pharmaceutical company, it would be safety and clinical trials.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in a bank, it would be issues around systemic risk. And so what executives need to think about is first step is responsibly managing your operations. So that if you think about how you're using water, you know, what the nature of your workforce is like, are you paying a living wage versus a minimum wage? Those are becoming table stakes, and investors are increasingly engaging with companies on that. That's different from the positive and negative externalities being created by your products and services. That's really what impact is about. And so I think companies first need to start, including up to the board, and I think it's more problematic at the board level, actually, than the CEO level. CFOs are kind of in between. Okay, it makes sense to pay attention to the material ESG issues, and it's not the laundry list of every sustainability issue. There's probably two things that everybody cares about: carbon emissions for climate change and income inequality, we can get into later. And then think about the negative externalities of your products and services. And then that leads companies to think about what their business model is, because it's easy to point to examples like tobacco. And I think you know that I'm an advisor to Philip Morris International. It's a long, interesting story we can talk about someday. So they need to transform. Oil and gas companies need to transform. Companies producing, you know, kind of fatty foods and sugary drinks, they need to transform as well. Companies that use a lot of plastics, we were talking about earlier. So I think every company needs to start thinking about the positive and negative externalities. What do they need to do in a world of limited resources, in a world where the framing of the sustainability development goals, I think, is good? But again, there's kind of a lot of greenwashing around that. So companies need to take a pretty hard-nosed approach to that and think about timeframes and think about trade-offs.
I often talk about the concept of a spectrum. And I think if a business leader or an individual thinks about this spectrum of, in my case, caring, but in the, say, in climate action, figure out where your brand is on that spectrum, and just the commitment to knowing that and moving further up or along that spectrum is where we need to go. I think sometimes business leaders are intimidated because they see that they're like Philip Morris, we'll talk about, you know, you start as a tobacco company, but where they're aspiring to go is to be a tobacco-free place, I believe. So they're not perfect, but I think in some ways, Philip Morris moves more along a responsibility spectrum than some brands that don't even go there at all. Is that a crazy concept? Or what
no, it's
think?
Not. I mean, here's the, look, it's easy to hate tobacco. I get it, right? Because of the industry just did appalling things for decades. But a billion people smoke, and that's projected to be constant. So what are we trying to do? Put the tobacco companies out of business? You're not going to. People are addicted to nicotine. It's incredibly addictive. So what you need, instead of divesting, engage with the tobacco companies. So Philip Morris is really in the lead, but you can see the industry moving in this direction to what kills people is the burning of the tobacco. What they're addicted to is the nicotine. Step one, replace cigarette smoking with, you know, heated tobacco products. They call it IQOS. It's not completely harmless, but it's 95% better than smoking cigarettes. Don't sell to any non-smoker of whatever age. And then they're moving into non-nicotine products because their business model has evolved from B2B to B2C. So they've learned about how to deliver substances in the human body. So ibuprofen is better delivered as an aerosol than as a pill. They have committed to having 50% of the revenues be non-cigarette products by 2025, $1 billion in non-nicotine based products. They have a statement of purpose signed by their board of directors and their proxy statement. They've got an excellent integrated report. They'll be coming out again in a couple of months. And I'm thinking, gee, if a tobacco company can commit to this kind of transformation with all of the glare that they're under and have their board sign a statement of purpose and a proxy statement and integrated report, any company should be able to do this. But, you know, it takes will and it takes long-term commitment. They've been investing in this, you know, for 20 years.
Yeah. And leadership, really. If a business person is trying to become more responsible or approach the ESG space, where to start? I mean, we talked a little bit about SASB, the Sustainability Accounting Standards Board. What do you tell someone who's new to this space to think about or to go, what sources to go to for some assistance?
So I think if we're speaking about kind of where things are at today, we can't ignore the fact that the SEC just came out with its proposed ruling on climate disclosure.
Mm-hmm.
But let me start with SASB. SASB has what's called a materiality map. And it's out in the public domain for free. And there's 11 sectors and 77 industries. And so it's not the gospel, but it's a good starting point. So a company just goes to SASB's materiality map and it says, okay, what are the 4, 5, 6, or 7 things that through these careful industry working groups of investors and companies and industry experts are really material to value creation? And here's what the KPIs to report them. So I think that's a good start. As you know, the Sustainability Accounting Standards Board merged with the International Integrated Reporting Council, which I was a founder of, to become the Value Reporting Foundation, so a new acronym that is now being consolidated into the new International Sustainability Standards Board established by the IFRS Foundation, along with CDSB, the Climate Disclosure Standards Board. There's a CEO, Emmanuel Faber, who was former CEO of Danone. They're putting a board together, the vice chair is Sue Lloyd. So what companies need to be very aware of is they've got SASB as guidance. That industry-specific approach is being incorporated into the International Sustainability Standards Board. If they're an American company, they won't be required to follow it. It'll be up to every jurisdiction. But if they're an American company, and this is a test for me of the business community, because there's a lot of happy talk about, you know, climate transition, and we all believe it, and da-da-da-da-da. Okay, so the SEC published a 510-page, proposed ruling on climate disclosure. You know, it's already become, incredibly fraught with, ideology, where you have the Attorney General of West Virginia saying he's going to sue and it violates First Amendment rights. I mean, the things that go on in this country are amazing, as we know. I want to see the corporate community during this consultation period, if they really mean it. One test for me, a litmus test, will be, do they write a positive letter? I mean, they can have some criticisms, they can raise some issues, but are they basically on board with the SEC or not requiring, climate disclosures? It's very sensible. I think it's modest what they're asking for. A lot of people are pissed off that they're not asking for more, but that's always the case with standard setting. Some people want more, some people want less. So what companies need to do to make sure that they are being authentic, they need to understand what SASB thinks the material issues are, decide whether they agree with that or not. Mm-hmm. They need to decide if they're going to support the SEC's disclosure. And this is all happening kind of right now. This movement to having, climate disclosure recommended, the ruling recommended by the SEC, we take accounting standards for granted.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have them until the SEC was formed. And these are all social constructs. These aren't derived from the laws of physics. Revenue recognition is a social construct. It'll be the same thing with climate. There's different technical ways to do it. So it's really important in the United States, and it's important for the rest of the world with the ISSB and in Europe for the Corporate Sustainability Reporting Director, for the business community to be aware of this, to be engaged in it, and to support these efforts.
You've just mentioned a lot of acronyms there, and that in itself, that alphabet soup can be sometimes challenging.
It is a little intimidating if you're not in the weeds on this, right?
Yeah, but what I also see and heard, which is great, is that we're seeing consolidation might not be the right word, but all these different systems of measurement and all these acronyms, the trend is moving in the right direction, right? There's more and more of a global consensus that A, this needs to be done. B, this is one way that collectively we can say, yes, this makes sense. Let's ease into it. Let's do it. So it's not as overwhelming as one might think at first.
I think you're right. If you look at the main arc, let the technical specialists and the people that are down in the weeds, like, me and my friends worry about that. The arc is that we're going to have a global baseline.
Yep.
We're going to get sort of harmonization on climate and then other things. But then the other thing to point out when you ask about what business executives should do, let's be clear about what standards can and cannot do. They're not a silver bullet. They're not targets. They're not net zero targets by 2040 or 2050. They don't sort of force the transformation of a business model. What they do is when companies set targets and make commitments, they give you accurate information on the extent to which they're achieving them or not, just like financial reporting gives you an accurate view of their financial performance. It's up to the executives to take a position on whether they're going to have net zero transition plans and to publish something like that. The investors need to engage with companies and push them on it. NGOs need to engage with companies. And then going back to companies, they need to be willing to engage. And historically, that hasn't been the case. It was kind of like, we're in charge. We're making money for you, please don't bother us very much. And that's another sea change. And ExxonMobil was the classic example of, not wanting to engage. And we saw what happened with engine number one.
You are the chair of KKR Sustainability Expert Advisory Council. What is the investment community? How are they actually getting there? I would think that they're really committed, but I wonder, are they really committed? I mean, they've created this entity that you are chairing and you're obviously giving them great advice. Are they being better citizens, so to speak, corporately?
So let me start talking about the private equity industry in general, and then I'll talk about KKR specifically. So it's interesting. Private equity has got a reputation, again, just like tobacco has a reputation. Okay, they make a lot of money and everybody gets screwed in the companies and, you know, they load it up
they
on
eat their children,
and, and they eat their children and the Gordon Geckos of the world. And again, you know, there's historically, you can understand, you know, why some of that, I mean, it's a little bit naive and I think oversimplified, but the private equity industry. So I have an article coming out in Harvard Business Review this summer. And the basic thesis is that private equity can take the lead in sustainable investing, ironic as that may seem. Mm-hmm. So why is that the case? Well, number one, they control the asset. So if they really take this seriously, if they believe in ESG as table stakes and operations and activities and impact, they pick the CEO, they pick the board of directors, they can ask for whatever information they want. So they've got more tools at their disposal than investors, a dispersed investor group in public companies. And 10 years ago, if you said ESG, it was like, I don't even know what it is. Mm-hmm. 5 years ago, we do an ESG DDQ when we're raising a fund and the LP, the people that mm-hmm. give them the money, the pension funds want this. Nobody pays attention to it. I did over 100 interviews for this research of general partners, the private equity firms, the limited partners, the pension funds that allocate assets. And they're all taking it very seriously. Really? And it's like very interesting. And the portfolio companies, the private companies know they need to take this seriously. So the private equity firms bring capabilities. They don't bring just money, but they know they need to deal with carbon. They need to deal with DE&I. They need to think about income inequality. And so I'm not saying the industry as a whole is there, but the leading firms I talk to and the leading LPs in terms of how they're allocating their capital, evaluating the sustainability capabilities of the GPs, of the companies. So the reason, one of the reasons I wrote this article, some of my colleagues at BCG, where I'm an advisor, is to kind of paint a picture of what the industry could be. Now, take KKR. I mean, they've been on this journey for a long time, you know, going back to, I think, something like 2007. Mm-hmm. George Serafim and I don't remember if we had that case in the course that you taught, but we wrote a case on them, what they were doing many years ago. I remember meeting Elizabeth Seeger. So kind of the core people I deal with are Elizabeth and Ken Millman and mm-hmm. Allison Fenton Willick. And so they came to me and said, look, we're thinking about starting the Sustainability Expert Advisory Council. And there's a little article about it in Fortune you can find. So it's kind of like, what's the purpose of this thing? And it was like, look, we've been working on this for a long time. We're paying attention to environmental issues, social issues, but we want to be better. And so we'd like to get together a group of people that have expertise in various domains, labor, data privacy, climate, to kind of push us, to challenge us, that we can kind of run ideas by, or we sort of
a sounding board
as much as we could. We're a sounding board of the things that we're not paying attention to. And, you know, we had our first meeting a couple of months ago, and the group is an impressive group. And kudos to them, right? I mean, we don't make investment decisions, but, you know, we're kind of an advisory group to an organization that takes this, you know, very seriously. And I'm hoping every private equity firm and small ones does a similar thing, because I think it's a way to not just kind of signal that you're committed. It's a way to help you be more committed, because you've got outside people that are experts in their particular domains kind of saying, you know, here's some other things that you should be thinking about. I think it's quite exciting.
Just out of curiosity, how diverse is that group? Do you see the diversity that the S and ESG might suggest?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know, look up the Fortune article. It's a diverse group, you know, in kind of all of the dimensions that you think about in terms of gender, you know, kind of ethnicity, you know, expertise, even age. You know, I'm 70. We've even got an old guy, you know, on this thing. Toby, I'm older than you. We've got age.
Barely.
Hi, it's Toby Usnick from The Caring Economy. Are you thinking about podcasting yourself? I'd highly recommend it. If you haven't heard of Anchor by Spotify, it's the easiest way to make a podcast with everything you need all in one place. So let me explain. Anchor has the tools that allow you to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. And when you're hosting on Anchor, you can distribute your podcast on listening platforms like Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and more. It's everything you need to make a podcast in one place. And best of all, Anchor is totally free. Download the Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to get started. And have a great success.
Ladies and gentlemen, again today on The Caring Economy, we're lucky to have Bob Eccles with us. He's a global expert on sustainability and the role of business in society, currently a professor at the Said Business School at Oxford. Bob, you just mentioned age, and I wonder, both geographically and age-wise or demographically, are there any characteristics of leaders in this ESG space? For example, is the Southern Hemisphere slower to pick up the tune? Are young people, what we're reading, are they really caring about this stuff? Does a KKR really have to do this in part because they can't get the talent they want unless they really commit to this? Any sort of generalizations you might make, either demographically or...
If I had to make one generalization, so like North versus South, that's complicated because, you know, you've kind of got the confounding of sort of emerging markets and the need to grow and develop the economies in ESG. It's an important topic we could talk about separately. I think the thing that's most striking to me is the age demographic. I mean, people keep talking about the millennials, and it's real. I mean, I own four millennials. I mean, I'm going to be poor for the rest of my life because I had four children and they all went to college and stuff like that. They're like looking at the future and it's kind of, you know, we've really got to deal with this. I mean, they're going to be around in 2050, you know, and probably not my son, you know, my kind of preppy son who went to Princeton on the crew team, now sort of, you know, a hipster vegan with a sleeve living in Brooklyn, working for an urban farming company. Danny's vegan because of climate reasons. I have a daughter who's vegetarian, vegan, more for animal rights. And so they are kind of living this in their own personal lives. And he's kind of a data scientist type who is working for an interesting company that did, you know, kind of marketing. So, but there's no meaning in that. So he's taking that same set of skills and he's applying it, you know, in a context where he sees it more clearly making a difference. That's what companies are running into and investors are running into. And what the private equity industry is running into is that if they don't think that the job that they have, whatever the pay level is, and whatever the particular domain they want to be working in, if they don't think it has meaning, if they don't think it's helping make the world a better place, if they can't see what the, you know, positive impact is they're having, if they think the company isn't authentic about the public statements it's making, they're having a hard time getting it. I mean, I remember a dinner at the Chamber of Commerce years ago, probably not supposed to talk about it, but it was so long ago, nobody's going to care. And it was about sustainability reporting. I said, gee, you're the Chamber of Commerce. You know, why are you having this meeting? And the guy who was the CEO looks at me and he goes, Bob, I talk to CEOs every day. And they're saying, if we don't do this, we're not going to get the millennials. So that demographic, if I had to flag one thing, you know, you can't get too carried away. I mean, the millennials aren't going to be CEOs for another 20 or 30 years. So you still got to deal with kind of who the incumbents are. But it's a powerful voice. It's true in the United States, you know, it's true in Europe. I don't think it's as true in the South. I don't think it's as true in China. So you do have kind of some of that geographical mix, but that's a really important shift.
Yeah, I actually was going to ask you about China. I spent probably before COVID, I was there quarterly in mainland China. I'm a big believer in China being a positive part of the future and that we need to engage with them. My husband works for a Chinese company. I don't think we can ignore it, but more importantly, the young Chinese people I've met with, worked with, they genuinely are engaged in bettering themselves and trying to be responsible parts of their communities and to their families. I mean, I'm certain that you've had a lot of Chinese students in your courses because they're such a predominant part of the international student bodies at great schools. Could you say a little bit more about China and your observations?
Yeah, I'm not as bullish on China as you are, to be honest. I mean, I was quite enthusiastic about China. I've been there, sounds like not as many times as you have, Toby, but, you know, 20, 21 times, mostly Beijing and Shanghai, but other places. And it was interesting. I mean, a lot of the younger Chinese that I met in the banks, they were more capitalist than the American students I make. You know, it's interesting. They were kind of more, it's like, you know, we're here to sort of make money. I think what's happening with Russia and Ukraine and the things that I'm reading about, you know, Xi Jinping, there was a scary article in the New York Times I read this morning, basically producing a documentary in support of what, you know, Putin is doing in Ukraine. I think it's dangerous what's going on in China. My Chinese friends are very cautious in talking about this. You can kind of see Xi Jinping kind of clamping down on the media. Yep. You know, they're being, you know, got their special relationship with Putin. So I'm pretty nervous about China. I mean, I'm not an expert on China, but I think if Xi Jinping is aligning himself basically with Putin and refusing to call out what's happening in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. What I foresee is kind of going back to more of a Cold War. Mm-hmm. And certainly, you know, you're not going to have the kind of globalization. People are going to be more concerned about having local supply chains, about energy security. So China's important. It's big, uses a lot of carbon. But, you know, I'm nervous about China. I think Russia's a disaster and is going to be for a while. And I'm nervous about the United States. I mean, the polarization that we have here that, you know, got worse under Trump. And it's like the left and the right are feeding each other. The left has become just too super woke with, you know, identity politics, and the right has become a cult, you know, and you have to say that the election was stolen. If we can't get past that, it's okay to have disagreements. Right. But if people are just locking into their ideologies, and anything a Democrat says is wrong or anything a Republican says is wrong, you know, we're not going to get the consensus that we need, whether it's climate change, whether it's social justice. And so, you know, we've got our issues in the United States as well, I have to say.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because I think at a minimum, China needs to be engaged constructively, because just the numbers alone, the population size and its diaspora. But college campuses are where you really see that divide as well, right? Like the wokeness and the conservative. Yep. I mean, and now it's we're going right into commencement season, right? So speakers are becoming, you know, part of that debate. You know, is this person, my own alma mater, Hampton Sydney, is going to have SAS speak at commencement. And that's causing some frustration for certain students and not for others. So it's definitely playing out. But if you go back to talking about your kids earlier, how are they building the bridges or finding the common ground, the millennials who say they want to have a better future for all, but they are at loggerheads with perhaps others in their peer group that feel very diametrically opposed?
Well, you know, it's a good question. And the answer is that they, I mean, this is kind of part of the problem. Is they aren't, because they don't have to, because they don't know any.
They haven't had experience.
Like they live in Boston and New York.
In bubbles, yeah.
Okay, so it's like, you know, who they know is like everybody like them. Yeah. Just like the people in, you know, Texas and Arkansas know everybody like them. And so, and even I have to admit it, I mean, I have to work at finding people that I don't normally come across.
Challenge you, yeah.
Who don't share my worldview.
Yeah.
Right. So I don't want to talk to someone that thinks Trump is the greatest thing since sliced bread. But I'll tell you an interesting story.
Yeah.
About a moment, I did a webinar with the NACD with a guy named Shivaram Rajgopal. Great guy. He's a professor at Columbia Business School. And this was an informal thing of a bunch of directors for a couple hours or two and a half, whatever it was, kind of, you know, governance and this and that and ESG. So we all go around and introduce ourselves in the beginning. It's kind of diverse industries, all that. There's a couple of women that were in oil and gas. I haven't said anything, right? So finally said, look, I'd like to, you know, Betty, Mary, whatever the names were. What do you think? And they said, well, I said, you haven't said anything. They said, well, we're usually quiet, you know, in calls like this, webinars. I said, how come? They said, people on the coast don't care what we have to say. I said, oh, that's interesting. So I said, you know, tell me what you have to say. And it was quite interesting. They were in oil and gas. They were thoughtful about it. You know, it's not as easy as people think that you just, you know, wave a magic wand and you don't have to have nuclear and you don't have to have natural gas and presto change it. We have net zero. You know, there's like local issues around grid stability. So we kind of got to the point where, you know, they were comfortable enough. And one was saying, you know, I'm a little bit uncomfortable about, you know, people from California coming into Texas. You know, it's becoming more like California than I like. And I said, well, I live in the People's Republic of Massachusetts. What's worse, California, Massachusetts? We kind of laughed. So then I said, do you think we listen to each other anymore? And she said, no. And that has stuck in my mind. It has stuck in my mind a lot. And I'm working on with some people to try and do like a 5,000 word paper on the energy transition that is apolitical, that recognizes that there's differences in points of view. Mm-hmm. But this kind of the doctrinaire hysterics that are coming out from the extreme right and the extreme left, mm-hmm. it's not turning out to be helpful. And right. So, you know, one of my own personal missions is that I want to be able to find ways to engage with people that don't know all the acronyms of VRF and SASB and GRI and ISSB, because we're all in this boat together. And I think all of us need to make that kind of commitment to say, it's fine to hold your own views and to sort of represent them in as articulate and well-argued a way as possible, but find people that can do the same thing that have a different point of view. And there's just not enough of that conversation taking place, in my view.
I want to talk more another time, Bob, because I think there's a way to do some storytelling and create dialogue around that. I want to let you have the last word today, and I'd love to have you come back another time. It's been really awesome just catching up. So any words of wisdom? Do you find that you have a mantra that you regularly cite to your students or your clients or any sort of words of wisdom for anyone anywhere in the world right now around ESG or about career choices, investments?
So this will sound trite, but... Mm-hmm. There's not kind of a single mantra. If I had to kind of boil it down into a soundbite, it would be authentic. So whatever it is that you're telling me, whether you agree with me or disagree with me, are your words matching your actions? You know, and there's a gap, and that's not surprising there's a gap, but trying to get people to sort of admit where, you know, they're kind of not living up to their own expectations. It's not my job to tell them what their expectations can be. I can say, I think you need to worry about climate change, your income inequality, your gender diversity, or whatever. They will form their own opinions, but then I think they need to take responsibility for their actions. I can say just personally, it's interesting, and this probably is an age thing. Well, I read this interesting book my wife gave me called Going From Strength to Strength. I'm finding myself less interested, like in the technical details of things. I mean, I get it for stuff.
You are an expert, yeah.
So it's like SASB versus ISSB versus GRI versus TCFD. I don't think that's the way to frame it. What I'm finding myself trying to do is, what is the common ground, right? As I was talking about before, whatever the initiative is. So let's work harder at finding the common ground. And that's what I'm trying to do because, you know, I know a little bit about a fair number of things. As you know, I'm not a deep expert in most stuff. I learn a lot from people that are. You know, I've got a pretty broad network. So what I'm trying to do is find ways to articulate that common ground and then take that to people across the whole spectrum of views. Mm-hmm. And I think if we had more people doing that, we'd be better off than this kind of just almost locked in.
Yes.
Ideological struggle and debate that we're in now, which is getting us nowhere.
Well, I like that concept of be authentic. I also think as an academician, as a scholar, as a researcher, you also exemplify something I admire, which is in being authentic, do your research, be grounded in research and the science of the matter, not just what talking points might be from your favorite broadcast or cable news channel.
Yeah, from your own point of view, get your own facts. Absolutely.
So, Bob Eccles, thank you so much for joining us here today.
It's my pleasure, Toby. Good to see you.
And please do come back.
Be happy to.
Thank you for listening to The Caring Economy with Toby Usnick. Please share your comments and questions with Toby via Twitter at TUsnick or LinkedIn at Toby Usnick. And thank you for sharing The Caring Economy with your friends and colleagues.